Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Taliban forces are sweeping across Afghanistan after the U.S. withdrawal. So what happens now? I'll discuss this with one of the Afghan women negotiating with the Taliban and a former U.S. ambassador to the country. Then,
right now, we believe that there still is time to negotiate a reentry, a mutual reentry into the deal.
Can the Iran nuclear deal be saved? I asked the former lead negotiator and U.S. special representative to Iran, Robert Malley. Plus, with just 9 days to go till the Tokyo Olympics, U.S. rower Brooke Mooney talks about the excitement and anxiety of competing during COVID.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Golodriga in New York, sitting in for Christiane Amanpour, who will be back next week. Well, Afghanistan is in dire straits as the Taliban takes over swaths of the country after the U.S. withdrawal. In a desperate attempt to restart the peace process, Afghan and Taliban delegations are set to meet again in Doha. The stakes could not be higher. According to the Long War Journal, more than half of Afghan districts are now under Taliban control. Already, there seems to be a tacit acknowledgement that they could take power. The British defense minister telling the Telegraph newspaper that the UK would work with the Taliban, this as France calls on its citizens to leave the country. Joining me now from Kabul is one of the women at the negotiating table with the Taliban, Afghan negotiator Fatima Gailani. Also with us is the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Ryan Crocker. Welcome both of you to the program. Fatima, let me begin with you, because when we're talking about the long-term consequences of a U.S. withdrawal, few would argue that those who stand to risk the most are half the population of Afghanistan, and that is its women. The former president, Karzai, said that he hopes one day to see a female president of the country. I think it's ambitious to say that we hope that girls will still be able to go to school in just a matter of a few years. I want you to listen to what former President George W. Bush said in a rare interview with a German broadcaster about this and how he disagrees with President Biden's decision to withdraw troops. Take a listen.
Sadly, I'm afraid Afghan women and girls are going to suffer unspeakable harm.
Is it a mistake? The withdrawal.
I think it is. Yeah, I think the consequences are going to be unbelievably bad.
Fatima, what is your take on this situation, particularly as it applies to women and girls?
Well, thank you. This is a very important question. No one believed that when the NATO soldiers, including the U.S. soldiers, came to Afghanistan, that they will stay until good. And today also, we are not telling them to stay for good. But what we are worried about is this negotiation, which has started here in Doha. It hasn't come to a state that would help the country not to go into a chaos. All we wanted was that these negotiations come either to a conclusion or a good progress, that it would give heart to the people of Afghanistan not to panic, and then give a hope that the institution will be saved, the country will be saved, what we have built for the last 20 years could be saved. And then, yes, Taliban are the reality of the country. Yes, it was a mistake that they were not part of the Bonn Conference. And yes, we will have to live together, but not like that, not push the country into a civil war. I think if we don't come to a political understanding at the negotiation table, it is very difficult to avoid a very, very bitter civil war.
And Ambassador General Austin Miller, who just stepped down from his post there on Monday, seemed to suggest exactly what Fatima is saying, that he fears that a civil war is on the brink there as the Taliban encroaches. We've reported that they've taken over, if not half, maybe a third of the region there. When you look at the response from local authorities who are now calling on various local tribes because the Afghan military, for whatever reason, cannot step up as they were trained to, are you also worried about a civil war?
I'm very worried about a civil war. In fact, I think it's already started. We are seeing the images of the Taliban on the move, as you've noted, various parts of the country, burning girls' schools as they go. So the war is on. The only thing that has changed here is that we have opted out. Our decision no longer to be a major player in Afghanistan doesn't end the war. It intensifies it. And it does so to the advantage of the Taliban and to the disadvantage not only of the Afghan government, but of all those Afghans. And certainly Ms. Gilani would be a wonderful example. Women have stepped forward at our request and our assurance that we would have their backs. Well, now we have to go. Goodbye and good luck. This is not going to end well.
And you have said recently that the U.S. would bear responsibility if the Afghan government is taken down by the Taliban within a matter of weeks, months, whatever it may be. President Biden seems to have a differing view. I want you to listen to what he said when asked this question about who bears the responsibility last week.
We did not go to Afghanistan to nation build. And it's the right and the responsibility of the Afghan people alone to decide their future and how they want to run their country.
So, Ambassador, you know, the majority of Americans, at least as of today, agree with President Biden's decision. You could make the argument that 20 years, thousands of deaths there, scores more on the Afghan side, billions of dollars spent. What more could even a few thousand troops do at this point?
Look, President Biden is right that we did not go to Afghanistan to nation build. I opened the embassy there after the fall of the Taliban, beginning of 2002. We went to Afghanistan to ensure that there was never again an attack on the U.S. homeland emanating from Afghan soil. That's why we went in, and that is why we remained. Now, beyond that, you can have a discussion, and we had many of them. What's the best way to ensure that Afghanistan or elements in Afghanistan don't threaten us directly again? We saw an educated, liberally educated population as a key way to that. We saw inclusion of all minorities and females as key to that. What we're doing now, we're not backing away from a nation-building role. We're endangering our own national security. The Taliban will be back in whole or in part, and they will be bringing Al-Qaeda with them. I don't think there's any doubt about that. So it wasn't about nation building. It was about America's security. And sadly, President Biden has threatened our own security by this ill-considered move.
And Fatima, you're taking part in the negotiations there. This is real-time impact on the people of Afghanistan before, and God forbid, we ever see another attack on the U.S. homeland. It is the Afghan region and homeland there that is at greatest risk as of now. Can the Taliban be trusted?
It is not a question of Taliban being trusted or not. It is the real story is that if there is a civil war, when there is a chaos, the bad doers will take refuge and they will have their homes in different parts of mountainous Afghanistan. And they will have a right in their own hand to do whatever they like. They could harm not only the region, they could harm anywhere they want. We saw the example one before. Why do we want to repeat history? We saw that the civil war caused the Al-Qaeda or whatever bad terrorist existed in Afghanistan. They took haven in Afghanistan and they were harming everybody from there. So why do we want to have this opportunity to them again? And poor Taliban, that they are part of Afghanistan. I do want to live with them in the same country. I do want with them to have a peace and prosperity in Afghanistan. And they should know better than anyone else that political settlement is the only way. Look, we were Mujahideen. We took the same way, places, this exactly the same scenario. When we approached all the communist army, because they were not really communist and they didn't care about the communist government, they were defeating and defecting to us left and right. And that's why the big players decided that we should not have a political settlement and it should be a military settlement. Did we reach peace? Until now, we are running after that peace when we haven't reached it. That was a wrong decision. This Soviet army and the communist regime destroyed all the villages. And we, the Mujahideen, with our civil war, we destroyed the cities. Should we do it again? Again, we will play the same game? Is it right thing to do? So I still have hope. I still have hope that now here in Doha, we are sitting from the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan and Taliban are sitting. No one said no to the peace talks. Let's go forward. Let's make a proper progress in this. Even if we do enough progress to give hope to the people of Afghanistan, things will change. And I strongly believe that if we have during the Eid festivities, which is very close, if we have a proper ceasefire, that will also show us whether the Taliban have enough control over their people to have a proper ceasefire or not. Let's see it.
And Ambassador, on that point, I mean, I guess that begs the question, you know, the United States or any country for that matter can't want peace and resolution more than locals on the ground there. And you can't deny that after 20 years and billions of dollars in equipment and training, that the Afghan army was left for wanting more. The U.S. equipped them well and trained them well. I think everyone can agree there. And yet when you see reports that the Taliban has already taken over large swaths of the country before even the U.S. technically fully withdraws, and sometimes without even a gunfire exchange at all, that some Afghan army members are just turning over their guns and surrendering. How does that leave you feeling as somebody who's spent and invested so much time there?
When I was ambassador to Afghanistan, 2011-2012, that was during the troop surge ordered by President Obama. We got up to 100,000 troops. That number has been reducing literally for a decade since then. And we and our Afghan partners were still able to keep the Taliban from holding a single provincial capital. With 3,000 troops or 4,000 troops, we and they were managing. It was a pretty cheap insurance policy, let's face it, against another 9/11. A relatively small number of troops, very low casualties. For whatever reason, President Biden has decided that any troops are too many. And now we've pulled out. The psychological shock of that is huge. And in the case of the readiness of the Afghan National Security Forces, it's important to remember they are deployed to many areas because of air support, not from us, but from the Afghan Air Force. Well, we're taking our contractors with us as we go. They are not going to be able alone to maintain those air frames. And we've already seen a diminution of air support from the Afghan Air Force to Afghan ground troops. So we are woven in, I think, to the this process of defeat, which I certainly hope does not culminate the way the last civil war did with the Taliban taking power. But we set this up for failure from the beginning by sitting down with the Taliban and without the Afghan government in Doha. The Afghan government joined later. Their negotiators have been nothing less than heroic. But we stacked the deck against them. We conferred legitimacy on the Taliban. We took it away from the government.
And Fatima, we are now at a place where thousands of Afghans are applying to leave for special immigrant visas, those that have helped and been allies along the way over the course of these two decades to the U.S. forces there, whether it's translators, whether it's contractors, security members. The U.S. government, the Biden administration today announced that it's launching Operation Allies Refuge, and it's an effort to relocate many of them to third-party countries to help them leave the country. And a few weeks ago, spoke with Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, who understandably would like for many of them to stay for the future of the country. What is your take? Is the U.S. doing the right thing by helping them? Is it too little too late? Would you like for them to stay? Are any security assurances available for them to stay?
I want everyone to stay in Afghanistan. I want all the millions of refugees coming back from Iran and Pakistan. I want all of us to be together, but it's not happening. So those people that they are going, at least they have some assurances and they have a future that they want to. If they want to do that, I don't think I'm in a place to tell them what to do. My fear is about those people that they are displaced inside Afghanistan. They are women and young people and children that they are leaving their areas and they are going to take refuge in other places. The panic of young women not to be forcibly married to people they don't know and who they are, by their family they are taking to another province. This is my fear. I was the president of the Afghan Red Crescent Society and I saw how disastrous internal refugees are, because internal refugees, they have to rely only on the goodwill of the province or the places that they go to. Sometimes they can afford it, most of the time they can't afford it. Today, Afghanistan is facing a huge drought, extreme poverty. What do you expect these people to go? So quite frankly, I'm not so much worried about those people that are leaving the country. I'm worried about those people that they are leaving their areas from one side of the country and go to the other side of the country. This is my worry number one. Quite frankly. And one more thing I have to say it, because we are not in this war for 20 years. We came to a war during the Cold War. It was 43 years ago. And because of us, a Soviet Union, a rival to the US, was no more there. And this is what you are getting. Wonderful.
So many generations, it's so important for you to note. We spend so much time focusing on, obviously, the U.S. involvement there on the ground. But for Afghani families there, this has gone on much, much longer. I want to end with you, Ambassador, and ask for your prediction. Given what appears to be a dire situation right now on the ground, where do you see things 6 months or a year from now?
I'm unable to tell you what I think is going to happen a month from now. What I do think is critical is that we step up our support across the board. We need to get contractors back in, particularly for the Afghan Air Force. We need to be getting the right kind of assistance to the people of Afghanistan. We need to do this in coordination with other friends of Afghanistan, primarily in NATO. We need to show that we are not, in fact, leaving the Afghan people to another horrific civil war. But unfortunately, the decisions that President Biden has made on Afghanistan have out-Trumped Trump. He has brought to an end our military presence during a time when we have not had a military fatality for over a year. He is, by his actions so far, giving away a positive U.S. role in Afghanistan to the benefit of the Taliban. It will stain the rest of his presidency. And I do hope that even at this late date, that our assistance efforts and our focus will be renewed and reinvigorated.
Well, another major potential player in this is neighboring Pakistan, which unfortunately at this point said that they will not be picking sides. They have a huge influence with the Taliban. Fatima Gailani, I know you have important meetings to go back to. Ambassador Crocker, thank you for your time and your service. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bianna.
Well, as we discussed, a lot is on the line for everyday Afghans. Just yesterday, new video reiterated the brutality the Taliban is capable of. A warning, it is quite graphic. It shows Afghan commandos surrendering before being gunned down. Amnesty International has labeled that execution a war crime. The Taliban deny any such event took place. Such violence is spurring on fears for other groups, especially Afghan women and journalists, as we had just described and spoke of. Our Anna Koren shows just how real that danger is in this report from Kabul.
Among the wildflowers and thistles, a sacred place in the heart of Kabul. The distant sounds of the city blocked out by the high-walled compound. Mohammad Kahiri and his son walk through the gates. Waiting for them, three mounds of earth, only a month old. They pick up rocks and tap on the gravestones, telling the souls, I am here and praying for you. Mohammed's world was shattered last month when his wife and two daughters were killed in a car bomb attack. As Hazaras, an ethnic minority persecuted by the Taliban and other insurgents groups, they have always been the target of terror. When I heard that, I didn't know the sky and I didn't know the land, he said. Everything went dark on me. However, his 23-year-old daughter Mina, a news anchor at a local TV station, had been receiving death threats for months. Her blossoming career and appearance on radio and television, a repudiation to the Taliban. Since it happened, I really hate this country, but what can I do? I see the future of this country is finished. There is no future. Over the last 20 years, the one industry where Afghan women have thrived is the media. Female anchors present the news alongside their male colleagues, an enormous step forward in this culturally conservative country. But it hasn't been without sacrifice. The Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 53 journalists have been murdered in Afghanistan since 1992. Local groups say the true number is more than double.
We earned our press freedom at a very, very significant cost. I don't think any other country has sacrificed as many journalists as Afghanistan has.
But the rise of an emboldened Taliban is now an existential threat to many Afghans, including local journalists, who know if the militants come to power, they will not be spared.
While the targeted killings and death threats have become commonplace here in Afghanistan, it's the deteriorating security situation that is unnerving many in the media industry. But despite these fears, there is a defiance, particularly among female journalists, who say they will not be silenced.
Among them is Mina's best friend and colleague, 23-year-old Zahara Siddiqui. She too has received threats, and while she can't remember life under Taliban rule, this young woman refuses to be terrorized into submission. We're Afghans and we will continue to do our job, she tells me. The goals that Mina had in raising our people's voice, I want to continue that for Mina. A voice pleading to the world to never abandon the freedoms this country has fought too hard to achieve. Anna Koren, CNN, Kabul.
Our thanks to Anna. And coming up after the break, six rounds of talks in Vienna and no end in sight. U.S. Special Envoy to Iran Rob Malley tells us what stands in the way of reviving the Iran nuclear deal. That's coming up. Welcome back. Today marks 6 years since the Iran nuclear deal was inked in Vienna. The five permanent members of the UN Security Council and Germany agreed to ditch some sanctions on Iran in order to limit the country's nuclear program. Well, it's fair to say that things haven't gone quite as its architects envisioned. The election of Donald Trump saw the U.S. pull out of the deal, leaving Europe scrambling to save it. Now, under President Joe Biden, the U.S. is returning to the negotiating table. I spoke about what's ahead with Rob Malley, a lead negotiator at the 2016 talks and the current U.S. Special Envoy for Iran. Okay, Rob, thank you so much for joining us. There have now been six rounds of nuclear negotiations in Vienna over the course of 3 months with no deal. What are some of the biggest sticking points on the U.S. end?
So it's hard to answer that question because nothing's agreed until everything's agreed. So to say that there's a sticking point would make it sound like things had been settled that have not been settled. But the truth of the matter is We've made clear to Iran what sanctions, the kinds of sanctions we're prepared to lift that are consistent with the agreement that was signed in 2016. And we've also made clear through our partners what we expect from Iran in order for it to come back into compliance with the deal. So I think it's pretty clear both what we would do and what we expect from Iran. We know that Iran has some decisions to make. They're in the middle of their own transition, their presidential transition. But I think those decisions need to be made and need to be made relatively soon if we are to reach a mutual deal of rejoining the JCPOA, the nuclear deal.
And since President Trump left that nuclear deal, Iran has enriched more uranium at higher levels, and it has more advanced centrifuges with less oversight, by the way, by the IAEA. There are doubts now because of this that even renewing the nuclear deal that was initially reached in 2015 would keep Iran from getting to a bomb at this point, given their advancements. Given all of that, is it even worth continuing this negotiation if they may possibly be able to put together a bomb and build a bomb within weeks or months?
Well, several things in your question. First, I mean, you make the point, you demonstrate why it's important to come back into the deal, because in the absence of a deal after the U.S. withdrew in 2018, what we've seen is Iran has accelerated its nuclear program. It's also intensified its regional activities against our partners. So every trend has gone in the wrong direction since we withdrew from the deal. Coming back into the deal would put Iran's nuclear program back in the box that was built in 2016, and that's our objective. There will come a point, but we're not there yet, but there will come a point where if Iran continues to advance its program and there's no deal, then it will be very hard, if not impossible, to recapture the nonproliferation benefits that were negotiated in 2016. That's not the case now. Iran still has a ways to go. If it intends to build a bomb, it still has ways to go to do that. We could still get all of the benefits that were negotiated in 2016 if we get back into the deal in the foreseeable future. That's our objective. But again, the premise of your question, which is absolutely correct, is that in the absence of a deal, Iran has been moving progressively along a path that is increasingly dangerous in terms of our nonproliferation interests.
And while you say there is still time to get Iran into that quote-unquote box, another Iran expert I want to quote, Ray Takei, thinks otherwise. And he has said, anybody who thinks that getting back to the JCPOA puts Iran's nuclear program back in a box has no precise understanding of the box. So I guess for our viewers, can we explain why you tend to disagree with other experts?
I don't think this is a matter of disagreement among experts. I mean, there's a reality, which is, as I said, since the United States left the deal in 2018, what we've seen is, as you've just said, Iran is enriching more uranium at higher levels with more advanced centrifuges and less oversight. That's exhibit A, B, and C as to why we're better off in the deal than outside the deal. I think the point that some experts make is, you know, if you're back into the deal, then over time, over in 5 years, 6 years, 10 years, Iran will be able to increase its develop its nuclear program further, and that's a concern that we have. But if you're talking about what we're aiming to achieve today, to get Iran's nuclear program back under control, I don't know any expert who would argue that we're not better off if Iran is under that control today than the advanced program that they've developed since 2018. So our goal is to get back, President Biden said this clearly, get back into the deal and then use it as a platform to negotiate with Iran other issues that divide us, of which there are many, and of which there are many that are very serious. But at least get the nuclear program under control so that we could focus on those other issues rather than have to spend time worrying about their nuclear program and worrying about other aspects of Iran's policies.
So, in your opinion, their nuclear achievements can still be reversed as of today?
Yes, that's my opinion, speaking as a nuclear expert, because I'm not one. It's our nuclear experts in government who say that as of now, Iran has not made irreversible progress. I want to emphasize that down the road, if we can't reach a deal in the foreseeable future, our experts will reach the conclusion that their advances are irreversible, that they've acquired the kind of knowledge that you cannot put back and push back in a box. And there, at that point, we will have to consider a different negotiation for a different kind of deal. We want to avoid that, and we would hope that Iran would want to avoid that too, because that would be a much more complicated negotiation. Right now, we're negotiating over a deal
That is very familiar to us because we negotiated it once before. And if Iran comes back into compliance with that deal, as I said, our experts say we will have recovered the non-proliferation benefits that we bargained for in 2016. And that's our objective now. That's why we're intent on getting back into the deal. Again, if Iran can't make up its mind and can't make its decisions in the coming period, we'll have to take a hard look and decide at what point the benefits of the deal that we negotiated in 2016 can no longer be enjoyed by a simple return to the deal as it was negotiated.
Is Iran going back to the pre-Trump uranium levels a must for the Biden administration?
What is a must for the Biden administration that Iran comes back into compliance with the deal as it was negotiated, whether it's enrichment levels, whether it's the kind of centrifuges that they use, whether it's the kind of inspections, the most intrusive inspections regime ever negotiated in peacetime. Those are the kind of things that we want to see. But that's black letter JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. That's what is required. There's not much of a debate about it. The steps that Iran needs to take to come back into compliance, just as there are steps that the United States needs to take to come back into compliance with the sanctions steps that we took in 2016. Again, it's not rocket science in that sense. We know what we need to do, and we believe we know what Iran needs to do, and the sooner we get there, the better.
Can you trust President-elect Raisi and in his incoming government? He is a hardliner, as you know.
Right. And this is a deal that was never negotiated on the basis of trust. President Obama said that many times at the time, and President Biden certainly believes that. This is not a deal that is premised on the fact that we trust Iran anymore. I suspect that Iran trusts us. That's why it's based on very intrusive inspections, on monitoring, the kinds that we negotiated in 2016, and will give us the eyes and ears, or give the International Atomic Energy Agency the eyes and ears that they need to know what Iran is doing. And that's what we need. It's not a matter of trusting their government. It's a matter of trusting the deal that was negotiated.
Secretary of State Blinken said that the Biden administration is, quote, getting closer to walking away from talks. If this continues, if they continue to spin more sophisticated centrifuges at higher and higher levels, we will get to a point where it will be very difficult as a practical matter to restore the framework of the original nuclear deal. You recently said, however, that you still think a deal is doable. Are you and the Secretary of State sending mixed messages? Are you on the same page here?
Absolutely. I think what Secretary Blinken said is exactly what I say, and I say it because I talk to him all the time, and I know exactly how he's thinking. I know how the president is thinking. And their view is, and our view as an administration is, there still is time to negotiate a mutual reentry in compliance with the deal. Otherwise, we wouldn't be going back to Vienna. So we will go back whenever Iran is ready to go back. We believe that we still have time to do that. At some point, I said that myself earlier, just a few minutes ago, and it's exactly what Secretary Blinken said. At some point, when Iran's nuclear progress will be such that a return to the JCPOA, because of the knowledge that they will have acquired, would mean that a return to the JCPOA would not give us the non-proliferation benefits for which we bargained in 2016. At that point, it's not a matter necessarily of walking away from the table, but it's that the deal that we've been negotiating is no longer the deal that we negotiated in 2016. We would need to see something else in order to feel like we get the same benefits that we bargained for in 2016. So that's the question. It's not a matter of walking away from the table. It's that right now we believe that there still is time to negotiate a reentry, a mutual reentry into the deal. That time is not infinite, and neither Secretary Blinken nor I has put a timetable on it because really this is a matter for experts, our experts, to tell us at what point they assess that Iran's nuclear progress has crossed a threshold where we can no longer go back to the old deal.
Yeah, and to your point, the State Department just said this week in terms of a seventh round of talks that will be held at a, quote, appropriate time. So we don't have a date scheduled for the next round of talks just yet. You focus so much on whether Iran is willing to comply here and come to the table, if they are serious about getting back to a deal. And I'm wondering your thoughts on President-elect Raisi's demand, at least public demand, that if any deal is to come to fruition now, that the U.S. president must guarantee that another administration, a future president, cannot unravel it all, obviously, seeing what transpired with President Trump. Given that I am sure he is aware that this is something a president himself in this country cannot do unilaterally without Congress, do you think that they are taking this seriously then?
Listen, I think that what they're saying is that they want to guarantee that there won't be a repeat of what happened in 2018. And our response has been consistent since we started these indirect talks early April. The best guarantee, the best assurance that the deal will be sustained and sustainable is for both to come back into compliance, to implement it faithfully, and then to build on it, as President Biden said throughout the presidential campaign and since he's been in the White House, to build on it to address other issues of concern, which will make the deal even more solid than it is, than it would be if we simply returned to it tomorrow. So get back into the deal, implement it over the coming years, and negotiate, follow on, or have additional diplomacy to address the other issues that divide our two countries. That's the pathway that President Biden laid out, and it's the one that we're suggesting to run. And by the way, back in 2015 and 16, when we negotiated the deal, Iranian leaders themselves were saying they don't want to see this deal as the end of diplomacy, but as the beginning of diplomacy between our two nations so that we could address the many, many issues that have divided us for now four decades.
And since then, we have seen a more hardline administration come in and be elected. I do want to ask you two final questions. One, in terms of Americans being held hostage, we know that there are at least four currently imprisoned in Iran. Is their release a must with regards to this deal?
Their release is a must. I'm not going to make any relationship or any link to the deal, but I would say their release is a must. Their release and closure in the case of Bob Levinson, who has been who's disappeared many years ago. Those are the cases that we've raised consistently with Iran. We're going to pursue them until they're home, until they're reunited with their loved ones. But again, this is a must simply because it's a matter of basic decency and basic humanity. They are imprisoned as hostages, as pawns, political pawns. They shouldn't stay an extra day in an Iranian prison. They should be home as soon as possible. And this is a matter of utmost priority for the president on down. All of us are dedicated to getting them home and to getting them home as soon as possible.
And final question quickly, Rob, in terms of Afghanistan and U.S. troops returning home there, we know that Iran hosted high-level negotiations and peace talks between the Taliban and Afghan government officials this week. In a joint statement, both sides said that war is not the solution to the Afghanistan problem. How dangerous is it, in your view, that Iran appears to be wanting to or is filling the vacuum that's left by the Americans?
I don't think this is a matter of filling the vacuum. I think that all of Afghanistan's neighbors should have an interest in a peaceful settlement and peaceful negotiations between Afghan parties. And so whether it's Iran or other neighbors, we would hope that they would play a constructive role because their stability also would be affected by what happens in Afghanistan. And so we would urge all of Afghanistan's neighbors to do what they can to ensure a stable future and prosperous future for Afghanistan.
Peaceful and constructive are the key words there. Rob Malley, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, just hours after that interview, we learned that four Iranian nationals were charged in an alleged plot to kidnap an Iranian journalist living in New York. Masih Ali-Nejad confirmed that she was the alleged target and told CNN that the details were shocking. Iran has called the allegations baseless and ridiculous. And still to come, piles of paperwork, pre-flight COVID tests, and mandatory tracking apps. CNN's Will Ripley takes a look at the endless challenges facing athletes and journalists at the Tokyo Olympics. Welcome back to the program. Tokyo's Olympic Village is officially open, and the games are kicking off in just 9 days. That's despite a COVID state of emergency declared in the capital, which on Wednesday recorded its highest number of cases since May. There will be no spectators, and the president of the International Olympic Committee praised Tokyo for being the best ever prepared city for the Olympic Games. CNN's Will Ripley captured the odyssey of traveling to the world's largest event in the middle of a pandemic. Take a look.
The first thing people ask when I say I'm going to the Summer Olympics, is that still happening? The second thing they ask, is it safe? My team and I are traveling to Tokyo to find out. Our journey begins 4 days before we fly. Two tests for COVID-19, 96 and 72 hours before departure.
Already there has been tons of paperwork to fill out, lines to wait in just to get to this point.
We can only go to testing centers approved by the Japanese government.
Okay. This is by far the most documentation I've needed just to get on a flight.
Processing my pile of paperwork takes nearly an hour at the airport.
This is the moment of truth. They're checking my documents. I think I prepared them correctly.
They have now brought in a man in a yukata.
Hello.
He tells me I need to download an app, fill out an online health questionnaire.
I have never been more grateful to get a boarding pass.
Only a few dozen passengers on my trip from Taipei to Tokyo. Many airlines are canceling empty flights or suspending service altogether. Athletes from Fiji have to fly on a cargo plane that usually hauls frozen fish. I'm just grateful to have a window seat. This is my first trip back to Japan since the start of the pandemic. Tokyo's Haneda Airport, eerily quiet.
As you can see, I don't have much company.
A handful of passengers, a small army of health workers, poring over my paperwork, scanning my QR code, ordering me to spit in a cup.
So gross.
The first of many daily COVID tests. Social distancing, not a problem as I wait for my results.
Negative.
Being here for the Olympics feels surreal and sad. Japan invested billions to host the games, banking on a tourism boom. This is not what anyone had in mind. The pandemic makes you appreciate life's little victories, like the moment I get my Olympic credentials.
Wow, there it is. It's official. Okano-san.
I clear customs and see an old friend, our longtime Tokyo Bureau driver, Mr. Okano.
Mr. Okano was the very first face I met in Tokyo.
Yes.
As we leave the airport and head to the hotel, it finally feels real. We made it to Japan. The process, surprisingly smooth overall, even as the Japanese capital fights a fresh surge in COVID cases. Will Ripley, CNN, Tokyo.
An Olympics like no other. We're glad he finally made it there. And when we come back, Olympic debutante Brooke Mooney joins us just before she heads to the Olympic Village. Stay with us. Welcome back. Well, the struggles in Lebanon happening with increasing frequency around the world. Poverty, government corruption, and mismanagement, all compounded by COVID-19, are fomenting the frustration and sparking waves of violence, like what we've seen this week in Cuba, South Africa, and where we started our show, in Haiti. This was obviously what we've been covering all week. Growing outrage and uncertainty there after the assassination of its president. Well, in South Africa, more than 70 people have been killed in protests and looting. At least one person in Cuba is dead in street protests not seen there in years. Our international diplomatic editor Nick Robertson has more on the growing unrest and how already existing problems are buckling under the weight of COVID-19.
From Cuba to Haiti, South Africa to Lebanon, tinder-dry tensions are igniting. Crippled economies burdened by COVID-19 are partly to blame. In Cuba, angry citizens, incensed by lack of food, medicine and freedom, as well as spiraling coronavirus infections, are getting beaten back by police for demanding the ouster of President Miguel Díaz-Canel.
America.
In a national broadcast, he blamed Cuba's economic woes on U.S. sanctions imposed under former President Donald Trump.
We explained to the Cuban people very clearly that we were about to enter a very rough period of time.
Reality is, Cuba's weak economy and healthcare system is being brought to its knees by COVID-19. Infections soaring, only a little more than 16% of Cubans fully vaccinated. The United States is watching with concern.
People deeply, deeply, deeply tired of the repression that has gone on for far too long. Tired of the mismanagement of the Cuban economy. Tired of the lack of adequate food and, of course, an adequate response to the COVID pandemic.
Haiti also a concern for the U.S. The audacious assassination of President Jovenel Moïse last week topped weeks of deadly street protests and fighting. fueled by poverty and factional infighting. The impoverished Caribbean nation, which has been an economic basket case for decades, saw street violence ramp up in recent weeks, concurrent with a spike in COVID-19 cases in late June. In South Africa, where COVID-19 infections have been spiking and vaccination rates are low, the economic inequalities are high. The army has been brought in to quell deadly rioting triggered by the jailing of former President Jacob Zuma on contempt of court charges. And Lebanon too is hitting a crisis, exacerbating pre-existing tensions of poor COVID readiness. Protest and anger ever present as rocketing inflation, rolling power outages, royal passions. The nation reeling from the economic impact of decades of Syrian civil war next door, compounded by years of political infighting. And to cap it all, a port blast last summer, shredding much of central Beirut. And Iraq this week became the latest country where tinder-dry frustrations combusted as they touched the nation's war and COVID-weary population. Oxygen tanks for treating COVID-19 patients at a hospital exploded, killing more than 90 people. Within hours, nearby residents took to the streets demanding better from their government. Living with COVID-19 has become not just a way of life, but a salutary warning for leaders everywhere. Nick Robertson, CNN, London.
And our thanks to Nick for that important report. And finally tonight, we saw correspondent Will Ripley earlier walk us through the complexities of traveling to the Tokyo Olympics. Well, now we want to turn to the athletes and what it's like to compete in these games in particular, during a pandemic. Brooke Mooney is heading to Japan in just a few hours as a member of the U.S. rowing team, and she's joining me now from Hawaii. Brooke, thank you so much for joining us. First of all, congratulations. You're part of a very elite, exclusive club going to the Olympics. How are you feeling right now?
I'm feeling good. I can't believe that we're finally within a few hours of our flight. I have been waiting years for this, and now, like, weeks and months, just so much leading up to this time to actually get loaded, get on a plane. It's surreal that it's actually here.
Well, Team USA Women's Rowing have won gold in the last three Olympics. I don't want to jinx you, but the expectations and the bar are very high for you. But this Olympics, as you know, I don't have to tell you, are unlike any other. You are going to have to be in a bubble of sorts there. Spectators are going to be allowed. You can't even bring your mom, your family, all of that. I don't know how you typically go through competitions, whether it's the family and the friends that are there cheering you on. How is this all going to impact you, knowing that this Olympics is going to look so different from what you've worked so hard to do?
In some ways, it's frustrating that it's going to be just the athletes and nothing else. But in going along with that, it's actually amazing that it is just the athletes and it's just going to be about competing. And we've been waiting so long for this time to get on this Olympic stage and just race. So I think it could actually be an amazing Olympic, just focus on the athletes and just focusing on the performance and not have any of the distractions of the fanfare or the spectators.
I love that perspective. And I love your personal story because, again, you're in this elite club where even the best of the best athletes never make it. You switched sports. You spent a majority of your youth and childhood skiing, as one does, I guess, growing up in Vermont. All of a sudden, senior year in high school, you decide to try rowing. And lo and behold, you're an Olympian. How did you make that transition? And what's the difference between a solo sport and a team sport?
I think the team sport is what I was missing in skiing. And growing up, I liked skiing. I enjoyed it. All my friends did it. And I got really good training and base fitness with it. So then when I did transition to rowing, I was able to take what I knew about fitness and my body and building strength and building fitness or endurance and translate it to rowing and then just have to learn how to row at keeping all of what I had learned from skiing.
Are there any pre-race rituals? Psychology plays such a huge role in this too. It's not just your physical fitness, it's mental as well.
Yeah, the biggest pre-race ritual that I do is I just try to sit in a quiet space, put my headphones in, and just be in the moment with myself for approximately the amount of time our race would be. This is something that I started doing more recently with the world record as well. And I really liked how I just sat there, kind of kept my composure, and was just present for the amount of time that I was expecting to be racing for.
And I would imagine it helps, going back to what you said about the team aspect of this sport in particular. It helps to have your teammates there with you, especially when you can't have your closest friends and family.
Exactly. This is like my teammates are my family when I'm not with my family. Like the bond that we have is amazing. And every single day it just gets stronger. And especially through this past year, we've really been pushed to the breaking point and we've come out stronger than ever.
Well, Brooke, just so you know, as I'm sure you already do, just because there can't be fans there cheering you along in the stands and bleachers and what have you, you've got fans around the world, particularly in the United States, that are going to be cheering you on and needing this reprieve now more than ever to watch the U.S. Olympians like yourself shine. So we are cheering you on. Best of luck to you and your teammates.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that is it for now. You can always catch us online on our podcast and across social media. Thanks so much for watching and goodbye from New York.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.